We welcome into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Look, which book would you like to read? Get them all. His newest is called If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. You could also check out his wonderful book on the 1951 film Scrooge. Or, you want a little music and more? Read Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Colin Fleming joins us. Hello, sir.
Hello, Richard. How's it going?
Fine, thank you. And you?
You know, the usual. Same old, same old.
Shirtless today while you were running those stairs?
No, I wasn't shirtless today because I was doing it when people are going to work. I've already been working for a few hours at that point, but all the people are coming up the stairs to start their day, and I'm out there doing my thing, and I'm already enough of a mess with the saliva going and the spit and the sweat and just this giant cloud of moisture coming, and so now I was clad today.
All right. Hopefully the woman in the coffee shop treated you better, but I'm guessing not.
That was strange, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that strange?
Well, it isn't, yet it isn't, because we just live in strange times.
You know, I was like at the Starbucks tonight, and the person there did the same thing with the change. So I thought, is this what we're doing now? So I decided to monitor this, but she did it with everyone. But the woman at the other cafe, she only does this change thing with me. It's in the blog, people, if you have no idea what we're talking about. But she stares at her shoes, she mumbles, and when she gives me the change back, it's like a dunk, but like a percussive dunk. Like, I'm showing you Dikembe Mutombo, you're not going to block this shot type of dunk. And she slams the change down and kind of like walks away. And I have had no interaction with this woman in my life, so I'm pretty confused by it. Not into it.
I don't blame you a bit. Well, let's talk about a number of things on the docket today, including a couple of interesting and well done radio dramas. Starting with a fun episode of Escape called Border Town, starring an unmistakable Jack Webb.
Yeah, we've had him come up a few times lately, not just from his Dragnet stuff, but from another Escape episode, I don't know, a week or two back, whenever it was. I thought this was, to me, it's uncanny how well done the Escape episodes are. And so this is nothing like out of the ordinary, like you're just wowed and knocked over by it, but you're pulled into it, where this guy's on the bus and he's going to Hollywood and he wants everything to go like fantastic from in Hollywood. It's really not. And, well, how would you put it? It's kind of a lot of fat shaming going on with this guy who's riding the bus, right?
Yes, he's got a nickname for everybody he encounters.
he gets off some real nice ones, too. And I know I'm not supposed to enjoy this, but I'm like, oh, yeah, mental note. I'm pretty into these. So, and I use them for motivation, too. Like, when I don't want to do another 1,000 stairs, the things I say to myself in my head, oh, my goodness, like, it would make the most intense hockey coach from, like, the 80s blush. Like, it's really wrong stuff. So I'm really digging this. It's like, and he's just making these wisecracks with this guy. And the guy is carted off the bus, and he's, like, he's arrested. And so it turns out that he's this counterfeiter, or he's part of some sort of counterfeiting. That's what he's arrested for. And the protagonist comes by this guy's money, like $15,000. And he thinks, well, maybe there's like an opportunity for me. I don't know what to do with this. And he ends up in this called Border Town episode. He ends up right like over the border from Juarez. And he ends up going to Juarez and he tries to sell this money thinking that it's counterfeit. And he has a series of experiences that probably didn't make for the best evening for him. But I don't know if you noticed this. Like, he's at this bar, and he thinks he's been found out, but it's kind of like, well, maybe he hasn't. He's not certain. He ends up being sent to this person who handles shady dealings like this. Did you know that person, it's like some fat guy in a hammock, but it's not actually a fat guy in a hammock. Do you know those Jeanette Nolan?
I didn't until after when I heard the credits at the end. I'm like, oh, okay, fine. I had no idea.
That's like Orson Welles's like Macbeth, Jeanette Nolan,
yeah,
as this like zaftig Mexican dude. And you can tell he's like that type of guy who can't even be bothered like to get out of the hammock to conduct business or like even barely open his eyes. And he sends him to like an even shadier person. And so the Jack Webb character ends up, well, he ends up on a chain gang, doesn't he? But
right.
It's like the most brutal, it's the most brutal chain gang. And William Conrad, who's the guy who comes on at the beginning of Escape, he's like, hate your life, think it sucks ass, Escape. Like, it's just like, they're really these sour sort of openings. He's the boss of the chain gang, the sadistic boss of the chain gang. And so eventually Jack Webb, his character, escapes. And there's a twist. But I don't really like the term twist, because a twist is like, they're usually pretty cheesy. The twist here is quite believable. And the whole plot isn't dependent on the twist. But the twist as such is what trips him up in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And what a cast. And also the wonderful voiceover artist Paul Frees was in the cast.
Oh, yeah. There's just so many people like it. It makes me think about the schedule. Like, we've talked about Virginia Gregg, who was in so many episodes of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. She's in so many episodes of everything. And so many of these people are. William Conrad is like, well, I mean, he's Marshall Matt Dillon. But if you listen to a lot of these programs, and once you start listening to them, I think the way it works is you couldn't just listen to a few of them.
Right.
You get hooked, and then you start exploring a lot. And you go way down with like one series, and it leads you to another series, that type of thing. I don't think it's like anyone who just like kind of listens to a few of these. And their schedules must have just been like these nightmares of activities. I don't know how they fit it all in. I mean, even it's weird, right, to have William Conrad doing double duty in this episode, because it's such an iconic opening. You think about like well-known openings or openings you always remember. And you have We Control the Horizontal, We Control the Vertical, like that bit of like tough talk at the start of The Outer Limits. But The Escape, I think, especially at mid-century, would have been one that everyone knew. Even people who didn't listen to the program, they would have known that whole thing about like, don't like your life, now it's time to escape. And then boom, there he is, working on the chain gang, but no Sam Cooke in sight.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. I was really fascinated by this episode that you sent my way from the Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater. When were these recorded? When did they air? Because they're terrific.
This one in particular messed me up.
So, oh man, it's like Play Misty for me, but you know, without the music.
Whew. Oh, but it's worse. It's one of the scariest things I've ever heard on the radio. So not a lot is known about Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater, and I like it a lot. I mean, obviously, I wrote a book, Buried on the Beaches, that's all these stories set on Cape Cod, and all of the time I spent on Cape Cod, I was never aware of this program. So it didn't run consistently, near as I can tell. It was like interminable, and every now and then there'd be an episode, so it'd be like the 80s, and I think it crept into the 90s. But I always think of it as like an 80s type of thing. And they set the scene as another night in Old Cape Cod. And I love that idea, Old Cape Cod, because like a geographical place, it's like it's not old. I mean, you know what I mean?
Right.
Older is not new, but it works here. It's like in Citizen Kane, the desert coast of Florida. Well, there is no desert coast of Florida, but you're pulled into that. And so this was one of the first episodes I heard from this program. And the people, so it's fitting here because it's a radio program. And this woman gives out like self-help, but it's not like lame self-help. She seems to be like a really caring person. You like her. You like her producer too. So people who just like radio are going to be keen to check this out just for that. And you get hooked on these characters, like the good people. And normally nothing is going to happen to like good people, especially like when they stick around for the entire thing, but she gets this call from this unhinged person, this guy, who actually sounds like a really husky woman. So that, like, sort of knocks you off a bit, too. And this caller is obsessed, and they're very captious. They're finding flaw and insult with everything that's said to them. Like, they're raring to go to fight. And they start talking about, like, seeing people who are not so good because they're covered in all these shadows. And I heard that, I'm thinking, like, oh, man, I don't like this. Like, what the hell is it? Like, that's a really original line for all of the sort of cliches and tropes that are out there. I haven't heard that one anywhere else. And so there's this frantic call from this, like, doctor, and it's kind of like a bit like Halloween, the whole, like, Donald Pleasance thing. And, you know, this person, we need to find out where they are. They escaped. They're in my care. And it's not even really who it is. But eventually this sociopath comes to the radio station. And again, this is not a good night. It's like a worse night even than Jack Webb has at the border town.
Yeah. But the conceit is so good. And obviously I'm a sucker for this as a radio guy, but I'm like, whoa, I can see this happening. I've been in a studio late at night with not too many other people around. This is awful.
You know what I pictured of it as too, is like this small building that almost has like strip mall type of feel.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost out there on like a traffic island, like in like Chatham or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
It's like a converted like oh, small. Like, you ever see like those Dunkin' Donuts where they're not quite a kiosk, but they're almost a kiosk.
Yeah.
They're a standalone store, and they're kind of like in between like two roads and like a railway station, and the fog drifts in, and there's a parking lot that maybe accommodates like five cars. And that's the low-key type of situation we have here. And you get the sense, too, that the listeners are like, they're into it, but there are like 30 of them. And then we get these calls, too, from these listeners, and we go into their lives. Like, we see these good faith efforts from this radio show host who's pretty good at their job, because she's not like a medical doctor, and she knows like when it's time to hand over something to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's very professional, and you get the sense that she's helping these people. We become caught up in their stories. You never expect, and it's not like a twist when it happens, because the mood has kind of sucked for like a while as we've gone along here. Well, I heard this like for the first time. Like, it's rare that I hear, I told you I sleep with these tonight. I heard this. When I heard it for the first time, like, I don't want to do this. I don't, like, I'm going to stay up for a while. Like, what's on TV? Is Last Man Standing on? I mean, I need to get my mind off this. It seriously is one of the two or three creepiest things I've ever heard on the radio.
Oh, I would agree with that completely. It's great. Check it out, Cape Cod Radio Theater. All right, from there to something a little bit lighter. I was so fun to see this. I had not seen this since, I don't know, probably when I was a little kid, the 1939 short starring Donald Duck, the hockey champ, as Donald teaches his nephews how to cross-check.
Well, I would say that they're the ones who pull like the 1974 Philadelphia Flyers when things aren't going there. There were like, remember like in the mid-1970s, there was like the whole hockey culture war between the Flyers, who just were, I mean, really criminals on ice.
Yeah.
And the Montreal Canadiens, and they played with such flow and grace and everything, and eventually the Canadiens dethroned the Flyers, who had repeated, and like hockey had righted itself and all that kind of stuff. So Donald is out on the ice. I was thinking about this. He's out there, he's figure skating, and he's really awesome, Matt. It's like, it's beautiful, all the moves he's doing. And I thought, well, you know what? Ducks are awkward in a lot of places, but they're pretty good like when they're swimming in the water. So it makes sense. I don't know. You freeze the water. The duck would be a good figure skater. His nephews, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, show up. And Donald is not only going to teach them hockey. He's going to school the boys, as it were, and to prove how good he is. I like when he does this. He pulls out, like, this sardine tin, looks like it is, from, like, inside his shirt. He doesn't have pants, of course, but he has the jersey. He pulls it out, and, like, it comes together, like he taps it, it becomes like this big trophy. You notice on the trophy it says like champion of Duck Swamp. I like this Duck Swamp because in some ways like it's so evocative. It's like a Victorian Christmas mystery on Duck Swamp. And he's like, okay, that's fitting. But at the same time, it's so on the nose. It's like, come on, Disney. Duck Swamp? I mean, really? So he scores the first goal. And technically, it shouldn't count because it's high stick. He high sticks the puck into the net. Like, all right, whatever. It's pond hockey. The thing that's great about Disney is there's so much attention to detail. It's a really convincing pond setting. If you look at the background, I think this is what Disney's reputation was built on. They're so believable. Like, again, you're just immersed in this. And so now the trio of the Sutter brothers here are going to half of the Sutter brothers, the Sutter brothers are going to have their revenge, and they just start gooning it up on Donald. But you know what? He's not much better. When he sees their reflection in the ice, you talk about boarding. I mean, he comes flying from across the pond. He's not taking any strides off to lay the, they're like his family. He's so willing to lay them out. But of course, he just crashes into the ice.
Got to let him know who's in charge here. It's old Uncle Donald. Well, let's talk a little baseball now, and love the story and love some of the interesting stats from this 19th century player, Icebox Chamberlain.
Yeah, Icebox. There were just some, you don't see personality like this in the game anymore. And I think really the golden age of personality for baseball was a long one. It was from like the late 1800s to the 1970s. And then it started going away. And now it's non-existent. And Icebox Chamberlain, and people might wonder how he came by his name. We're not totally sure. It seems that he was cool under pressure. Like, oh, don't worry, boys. I know we're facing elimination, but we got old Icebox on the mound tomorrow. He's like 24. Other people think it was because he was like so annoying. He was so weak. Like all of these dissenting theories. But he hurled in his short career just an unholy amount of innings and walked an unholy amount of people. And you get the sense that like the game was, there just was just more pace to the game, even with the walks. And it's strange because he was one of those players at the turn of the century. And I don't know why they all did this, but there are so many of them. It's a theme. He quit playing. Again, he's in his 20s to become an umpire. And I don't know why all these guys did it. I've never heard anyone like mention it, talk about it. I don't know if anyone else has noticed it. But when I was like researching all of these like early players, it's almost as if their goal was like, well, now that I'm 28, it's time to hit the big time in umpire. Like you went from vice president to president, and that was umpire. But then when they had this umpiring career, like it lasted for 6 games. It's really bizarre.
Some of his stats are crazy. He had 3 seasons with over 400 innings pitched. And then the 1891 season, he struck out 204, but walked 206. And that was one of, I think, 3 or 4 seasons where he walked more than he struck out.
You know who that's a little bit like? That's a little bit like Nolan Ryan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because Nolan Ryan, it's like we can get into this, but like Nolan Ryan is one of those guys. He's like the pitcher version of Pete Rose that people just overrate so much. I don't think they understand that like no hitters and strikeouts are not the end all. Like no hitters are kind of fluky, and strikeouts and out is an out. So what does it's like in hockey. You ever think about like when Wayne Gretzky scored like 92 goals in a season? You ever think about like the nature of the goals? You just think that he scored 92 goals. And when Ovechkin breaks the all-time record, you're just going to think about that's what he did, the number. So the innings pitch, is crazy as that number sounds right now, I mean, it's like 3 seasons for a starting pitcher these days. That was kind of like middle of the road at the time, because we've talked about some numbers where some guys are getting over like 500 innings pitch. You can be like your team's only pitcher. And then there's like some poor bum in the bullpen who comes in once a week when like you get soft and you don't finish the game. And but what's interesting about baseball, though, it's cool. I mean, yes, there are like certain exceptions, but you go all the way back to the 19th century And the stats are still, like, for the most part, they're pretty consistent. Like, no one scores 300 runs in the season. Like, you still lead the league with 126, like you do now. And the starting pitchers, sure, that was different, but you had these characters, and I don't know. I just, there's nothing like an icebox Chamberlain in the game anymore. I mean, icebox is he's like a precursor of a Louis Tiant. Or Mark Fidrich or whoever. It's just colorful pitchers.
And I like the little throwaway line, the Baseball Reference. Chamberlain alternated arms during at least one game.
Yeah, at least one. Like, we don't know how often he busted out this move. And you know another thing that's remarkable, too, is, like, as far back as you go, and we're talking, like, sometimes guys born before the Civil War, the stats exist. Isn't it just like, no one talks about that. Isn't it just crazy that, I'm sure they're off here and there, but just that they exist and that we know someone's ERA and someone's slugging percentage, and we have the data to figure that out. And we can look at, you can look at Icebox's war. Imagine, like, if you were Icebox thinking all of these years later that a couple people would be discussing, like, your innings pitch and your war. and I mean, but it's fascinating to me, too, because these guys took this seriously. It wasn't just like, that's what I initially thought, like, a long time ago when I got into early baseball history, that it wasn't considered like a real job. It was just something you did as a diversion for a year or two, and then you went back to, like, the hay. It wasn't. It was like a career. They looked at it as a career the way guys do now. I mean, the money, everything was different. You had to do other things. But there were still guys who had, like, 17-year careers. Like, it's how they identified.
Right. From there, we wrap it up with a discussion about a great year that often goes overlooked by Carl Yastrzemski. Now, Yaz in 67, Triple Crown, one of the great seasons in baseball history. And yet, if you look at war, his second-best season, I don't think many people would guess this, Colin, was the very next year, the year of the pitcher.
Right, and his war was, I think a lot of people look at the 67 season who saw it, and they think, like, with their eyeballs, so to speak, like, that he, every time the Red Sox needed a big hit, he got it. And you know what? Like, he actually did. So that isn't just, like, apocryphal, and it's not just, like, all of the eyes. No, like, the numbers bear it out, too. It's crazy, crazy war for that year. Like, just one of the all-time great years. However, you want to look at it. Memory, nostalgia, metrics, sabermetrics, like, he did. So in 68, he's not quite the same, but he has one of the all-time best years again. And if you just look at, like, his counting stats, like batting average, and I guess that's the stat people know, because he was the only player in the American League who hit over 300, just barely. But I thought we'd talk about this in the context of, I don't think that people understand. I think baseball has so many issues, and one of the issues is the divide over how numbers work. Like, you have people who are numbers and nothing else, and then you have other people who are just, like, nostalgia and memory and nothing else. Like, I mentioned Pete Rose. When you go on, like, groups on Facebook, like baseball history groups, everyone thinks that Pete Rose is one of the, like, four or five best players of all time. And Pete Rose is, like, maybe in the top 100, career 303 hitter, no power beyond doubles. The same with, like, Ichiro Suzuki, who is a slightly above average offensive player for his career. Like, that's it. He's a singles hitter. And if your primary value is in singles, you can only be so good. Like, you'd rather hit 265 with 34 home runs and have an OPS of, like, 907 than hit 350 and just singles. So Yastrzemski was still doing this total package thing in 68, and the Red Sox weren't going anywhere that year. But you look at those numbers, and they seem so, I don't know, humdrum, really. Like, they're not that dissimilar outwardly from his 1977 numbers. More RBI in 77. But he's in, like, the top 5 or 10 in everything. He's dominating again. So for 2 years, really, your man was the best baseball player in the world.
Well, yeah, and in that 68 season, yes, he only hit 301, the lowest batting average to ever lead the league. But the next closest guy was Danny Cater at 290. And 10th in the league that year was Frank Howard at a very pedestrian 274. That's how depressed the numbers were that season. And on base percentage, Yaz had a 426 OBP. The next best was Frank Robinson at 390. He just dominated.
Pretty good player, too, in Frank Robinson, who still had some game in him. And that's interesting that you put it that way, because, like, it's one thing to look at Yastrzemski at the 301. But what I like to do is, because I consider it a pretty good season when you're in the top 10 in, like, major categories. So, like, Carlton Fisk is my favorite player. I like that he was in the top 10 in home runs in 1973. He only had 26. But that was like a lot of power back then, because the pitchers, it wasn't just 68, they were having the run of it for a while. Like, you have years in the 70s where, like, Craig Nettles is leading the league with like 32 home runs. So when you're in the top 10, like, you think that's pretty good. If you're in the top 10 in batting average, not a lot of people can ever say that they had a season in their career where they're in the top 10 in batting average. Like, it's just, it's rare. So I always go when I look at 8, 9, 10 to see what those guys are doing. And when you see the 270s, that makes me really not impressed with them. It makes me all the more impressed with Yastrzemski, whose all-around game was phenomenal. For these 2 years, he was as good as you had in the entire world. And so then it makes, like, it sort of begs the question, did Yastrzemski underachieve, do you think, over the whole of his career? I know all, like, the numbers are, like, there at the end, but given how he was in 67 and 68, and then he's doing a lot of power in, like, 69 and 70, but he plays for a long time after that. Does he underachieve, like, in the 70s, given what he was capable of?
Well, I think he did, and you wonder if he wasn't worn down, because when you look at those games played from 66 to 70, he played at least 157 games every year. And then you start to see the numbers go down when the little injuries began to catch up with him, as they do in the early 30s. And he would never again, only once, play more than 150 games for the rest of his career, which was another, you know, what, 13, 14 years.
He has a fascinating career because he leads the league, like, in just about everything at some point or other. But they're really, like, sort of spread apart. I mean, he has the Triple Crown year, obviously. But when you look at his so-called black ink, they're not, like, clustered, like, within just, like, a 5 or 6 year peak. He's doing, like, one here, one there. He has, like, some random year in the 70s. I want to say it's, like, 1974. Where he leads in, like, either on-base percentage or, like, OPS. And it's like, what? Why is this random black ink here in this year? Now, I think it's unfair when I've heard people in Boston media say that he's overrated and that he didn't win, and that's one part of it, and he was a compiler. That he didn't win. Like, he did as much as humanly as possible for any athlete to have his team win in 1 year. In 1967. Right. You can't do more than that. I mean, he's not even like a favorite of mine, but you just can't. And then even when you get to the postseason that year, he's much better in the postseason somehow than he was in the regular season, which doesn't seem possible. And the compiler thing, he was always good. But even like when he had the, I think it's 102 RBI in like 1977, my sense is that he was a product of the offense that he belonged to, that they were such a powerhouse that you're going to come up an awful lot with runners in scoring position and do your sack fly type of thing to right field.
Right. I think even Butch Hobson drove in 100 that year.
Yeah. It was like one of those offensive years, just like 87 would be, where you had the sense that maybe something was done with the ball or whatever it is, but like so many guys had career years, 1977 and 1987. And they were like, I mean, my guy Fisk was awesome in 77. Like, it was exciting. But you look back on those numbers now and they're like, it's not like everyone was popping 50 home runs or anything like that, but But I don't know. It's just that that year, it illustrates that schism to me. The people, I saw this thing in the Facebook discussion group the other day where this guy was, he wasn't like some old guy, but he was, I don't know, maybe like 60, and he was saying that baseball has kind of lost him. And his interest in baseball is like reading baseball books and old games and even baseball cards and things of that nature. And it's like his Stratomatic leagues and stuff like that. I think that this sport is completely underestimating the extremity of their problems, because I think that's like a lot of people who really love baseball find a way to partake of baseball, and like I do too, through like Baseball Reference. If you can be sustained through that without having to like watch whatever's going on when everything starts going on again. And I think that's where a lot of the people who love baseball have turned to. They're within the game, but they're also apart from the game now.
Go back and check out baseballreference.com. That's 68th season for Carl Yastrzemski. If you just remember it in your mind's eye, go back and look at those numbers and look at them in context, and you'll be surprised. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Colin, thanks as always. We'll check in with you again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.